On this episode of the Practical Guidance Podcast Labor and Employment Series, we hear from attorney Richard Cohn. Richard is a partner with the firm Fisher Broyles in their New York City office, where he's a litigator and specialist in employment law. Today, Richard and I will have a discussion about discrimination in the workplace, looking at Title VII, the line between acceptable and actionable language at work, as well as hiring practices and other areas related to modern-day employment litigation. I'm your host, Kevin Hilton. I'm an attorney with LexisNexis. To learn more about LexisNexis Practical Guidance Research Solutions, visit lexis.com. Lexis Practical Guidance gives you insights to support what you do. Richard, thanks so much for taking this time to speak with me today for the Practical Guidance Podcast. I wonder if you'd just start by telling the listeners a little bit about your practice.
I now practice with the firm of Fisher Broyles in their New York office, and litigation is the main thing I practice, but I have a subspecialty in employment law and employment discrimination.
Clearly, words and language are extraordinarily important in the workplace. Would you start by just giving some context to our listeners about Title VII, the evolution of it, and its connection to the line where language crosses over to creating problems within the workplace?
Most of the, or if not 99% of the employment discrimination law came out of the Great Society of the 1960s and became what we're all familiar with as Title VII, the Age Discrimination Act, the Anti-Discrimination Act with respect to disability, et cetera. I got out of law school in the late 70s, and I ended up working initially litigation department of the City of New York Law Department. My first trial out of law school, my first jury trial was a federal trial. I think I was 24. I was just admitted to the bar, and I was the only lawyer, you know, for the city in a jury trial involving race and ethnicity discrimination. There was very little written about Title VII then, and race discrimination and ethnicity discrimination. But now it takes up a whole library. But that was in the early days when Title VII was just birthed. And the workplace is really a microcosm. It's really a microcosm of society, and it sits on all of societal faults. And what happens in the workplace, you can be sure, is just the microcosm of what's happening in the so-called real world. You asked me about discrimination, and when Title VII didn't start out as an anti-harassment statute, but when it subsumed harassment in the workplace, number of cases just skyrocketed, and especially cases involving age discrimination or race discrimination, which when Title VII started out and when harassment became subsumed, people didn't know what was really prohibited in the workplace. It was yet to be litigated and yet to have a lot of decisions. And, you know, the workplace of the 1950s still lingered in the 1970s and 80s and to today, as the Me Too movement has shown us. And people were certainly not above using the most freighted language, the most vulgar language, and the most offensive language in dealing with people of age, of color, with disabilities. You can imagine there was very little holding back, you know. So whatever you can imagine, what you saw in Mad Men, or what you can imagine even worse than that, was really still in the workplace. Now, after thousands of cases and enforced mandatory sexual harassment, for example, anti-harassment training in the workplace, as there is in New York, people are much more careful with their language. They don't come right out and say the bad words, you know. But some people still do, of course. Some people still do, but for the most part, the courts are now dealing with words that are, I don't want to use the word euphemism, but the words that mean the same thing, but it's harder to decipher. I mean, for example, I remember a case some years ago. I represented a woman who was in her 60s. She was the only woman on the executive floor of a small corporation. And she was terminated And at that point, I was doing representing employees, and we sued for both age and gender discrimination. And I was deposing the president of the company, and depositions are always very, very, very revealing, and they're always a surprise. Surprises come out left and right. And I was asking about other people who were terminated, and at one point, because it was getting late and this fellow was getting tired, I asked, well, how about John Doe? What about him? He was terminated. Well, how old was he? And this fella, the president, looked up and go, oh, he was ancient. I said, really? How old was he? And it turned out he was exactly the same age as my client. And suffice it to say, we pretty much settled that case right then and there. The word ancient was used here. Okay, it doesn't leave much to the imagination. We know that ancient means old. But other things that have been said, and I, in some of the articles I've written for Above the Law, for my blog, I've tracked, for a few years, I tracked every case I could see around the country where the court was dealing with words that substituted for old age. And there was a bunch of them I had that I wrote about. One was, he has very little runway left. And so again, some of these are pretty obvious. Some are a little less obvious, but it's still using words that are direct evidence of age animus, age discrimination. Low energy is a good one for people of age. Some of these cases were a little more out there. Like, he's a bag of bones. A lot of companies, when they advertise for various positions, and they don't want to say old people not wanted, or don't apply if you're over 40. So they say IT experience desired, familiarity with the internet and all aspects of information technology. And that has been held in various cases when it's appropriate to be a stand-in for the word, we don't want people of a certain age.
You mentioned one way that companies are discriminating in their hiring based on age. Are there other problematic methods you're seeing companies use today?
Well, you know, a way that a lot of companies have gotten around trying to weed out older people by using cleverly worded advertisements is some companies at least, and the cases are starting to multiply. Some companies are actually advertising only in college newspapers or places that they know older people will not read. So they don't have to be as clever and say, we only want people with a lot of experience, in this, or high energy people. They just advertise where only young people read it. And cases have come down, decisions have come down, where the courts have found in favor of the would-be employee, the applicant, when they found that, in fact, this was exactly what was intended by the company, to advertise just in places, on social media, more particularly, where only young people will gather and will read or will attend. Companies have also advertised in certain area codes or zip codes, hoping to attract people who are not over a certain age and not of a certain race, etc. But these people are very clever, and the law lags behind society. And as long as people will be clever and want to achieve something that is not appropriate or not legal, they'll find ways to do it. Cases will catch up.
Sounds similar to redlining.
It's not so different than the old redlining that banks and finance companies used to do, based on people's addresses and in order to exclude certain races from living in certain areas.
That's some great insight on companies and hiring practices. Would you talk a little bit about the line where termination could be seen as discriminatory?
A lot of people used to come to me and say, I was dismissed and it was a wrongful dismissal. And I'd say, you know, being a New York lawyer, what would made it wrongful? They'd say, they had no reason to do it. And I would go through the list of protected categories like, you know, race, religion, nationality, etc. And they'd say, no, none of those. I just think that they treated me badly.
Right.
And unfortunately for employees, at least in New York, and at least now, wrongful termination in and of itself is not actionable. You have to have a termination or some sort of a diminution of the terms and conditions of your employment that's based on some protected class that you're in. It's not sufficient that, in fact, you know, it was not fair. The same thing also, which is perhaps deviating from this topic, is that I used to get a lot of people, you know, writing to me when I was doing all these articles about bullying in the workplace. Right. And they'd say, I was being bullied. I wanted to sue. They bullied me. And I said, was it based on any classification of yours, race, age, etc.? No. I said, unfortunately, in almost every, in fact, I think at every state, except for a couple of little jurisdictions, some municipalities and things like that, there are no anti-bullying in the workplace laws. It has to be based on some characteristic like race, age, nationality, etc. It can't be just because the person is just being obnoxious to you. Again, without getting into whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, or whether there should be anti-bullying laws or not, that's just the way it is. So at least in New York, you know, wrongful termination and bullying with nothing more does not confer upon an employee any actionable case.
So determining the line between discrimination and just firing is clearly very tricky.
I can tell you that I think every person who was terminated probably thinks they have a good case.
Right.
And in fact, you know, I had situations in the past when I was doing work for employees where I had to sort of do a lot of digging to determine whether or not they had a case. They started out by saying, no, it wasn't based upon my age or my race or my gender or anything like that. I'd say, well, did anyone ever say anything to you? Well, maybe once or twice. Or let's look at the statistics. How many people of your race were you know, in the company? Just me. How many people were terminated? Just me. On things like that, you build a case, even if the person doesn't even realize it. But those are not for harassment cases as much as for just plain discrimination cases.
I know you've done some writing on the topic of the use of discriminatory language in the workplace.
Besides following the language that courts found offensive in discrimination or harassment law, I wrote a lot of articles and I followed the number of cases where people were being harassed in the workplace. People who were African Americans or people of color, Americans, people from the islands, for example, that it always appeared that when race was alleged, there was always the N-word being used. Again, the N-word is hardly a euphemism for what it stands for. Euphemism being something that's nicer, but in fact, the courts would say the N-word rather than what it stands for. But I found that it always appeared in race cases where there were African Americans, and it almost always was coupled with nooses being hung in the workplace, KKK slogans being written on people's lockers, white hoods being displayed, all kinds of the worst stereotypical offensive racist comments and memes were always used, but the N-word was ubiquitous. It was always there. You mentioned before, you alluded to before, if one situation in the workplace as opposed to many. The law has been pretty clear for a while that, you know, you can claim harassment if the harassment is pervasive or severe. Pervasive meaning many, many situations, or severe meaning something totally intolerable. And I followed this when it came to the N-word, and I found a situation where federal appeals court, where then Judge Garland, now Attorney General Garland, was sitting on the court, and they determined that one N-word used in the workplace was so offensive, it brought back so many historical references that were offensive, that a single usage of that word was sufficient to create a hostile workplace, which is the touchstone of what makes a case harassing.
Right.
And I found another case where one of the Supreme Court justices now was sitting on a lower appeals court, where the court said that, well, one or two or even three N-words, that's not so terrible. You know, if it's only a couple, that's no big deal. And I tried a little thought experiment, and I just wrote, I think it was in Above the Law, I wrote to all my female readers out there, is there any word that you can think of that deals with gender that is as offensive as the N-word, where one usage is sufficient for you to feel that it's a hostile workplace? And it was unanimous. There was one word, and I'm not going to repeat it. There was one word, and every female that wrote to me said, yes, one time usage is enough for me to feel absolutely horrified in the workplace.
So currently there are two federal appellate court opinions with very different views on how the volume of use of discriminatory language impacts a claim.
Yeah, they were federal courts of appeals.
Wow.
Law is so fascinating, and as it is applied from one jurisdiction to another, when it comes to things like race, a court in the South would likely have different life experiences than a court in New England. And,
right.
And you know, life experiences are what makes law alive. And, what makes it all the more important to have, an appeals court that has more than one person on it. You know, you want to bring together a diverse group. And you're seeing much more diversity in the judiciary now than at least when I was coming up.
We spoke a little bit earlier about how companies are getting into hot water with their hiring. Are there other technological hiring tools that companies are using that are potentially problematic?
Well, it's interesting. You know, as corporations, as compliant corporations, are trying to do all they can to comply. One, because it's the right thing to do, and two, because it's the legal thing to do, they're finding themselves stepping into quicksand, even when they have the best of intentions. And just an example, a lot of companies will create algorithms as to who they want to hire, and they figure, well, algorithms and the hiring process, that can't be discriminatory. It's just a computer that's doing the creating of the job specifications and what the tasks are and going through the resumes to pick the applicants who will fit the bill. But algorithms do discriminate. It's been found many times that algorithms discriminate, not because the computer discriminates, but because, you know, what goes into the computer and what goes out of the computer, it's all created by humans, and humans have, you know, an unconscious bias And, you know, meaning that they don't not even aware of it, and that'll go into the algorithms that they create. So those have been tested in court, and those have been found to be on occasion discriminatory. So even those corporations, those employers, those clients of mine who have done the best to be totally neutral when it comes to hiring, even they find themselves in hot water.
So what's the underlying message you give to companies at this point trying to navigate waters?
You try to have a zero tolerance workplace for discrimination, for harassment. Some people don't like that term zero tolerance. They think that's too rigid a test, more of a flexible test. But I kind of like it as it's something that people remember. But zero tolerance. And I tell the companies that the workplace really is governed by the ethics, the morals, the respect that should be shown from the top down. It has to go from the top down, from the top C-suite offices down to the workers on the line.
Richard, thank you again so much for your time and all the insight you've provided today. To learn more about Richard's practice at Fisher Broyles, visit the firm's website at fisherbroyles.com. As a note, if you're enjoying these podcasts, please subscribe or follow the Labor and Employment Practice Area series you're listening to right now. Lexis is also offering a monthly practice-specific data privacy series. We're launching an investment management series in the coming month. And we continue to create a rotating practice area series every month. All of these practical guidance podcasts can be found through your favorite podcast provider and as transcripts on Lexis Practical Guidance Research Solution. And remember, no matter your practice area, if you need practical guidance on how to proceed in your work, check out Lexis Practical Guidance Research Solution, available now through Lexis. For more information, visit lexis.com. Thanks, and be well.